This show is part of the Goblin Broadcast Network, mate. You probably knew that, though.
Don't worry, friend.
They won't find you here.
You're safe now.
Oh, thank goodness I found a gamer's haven.
This is Ethan of the Gamer's Haven podcast at www.canadiancrusaders.com. This podcast is part one of our Gen Con post show. Keep checking in over the next couple weeks to hear interviews with some gaming insiders, other podcasters, and various other things that we got at Gen Con. To kick us off, we're going to have the Goodman Games Seminar of How to Write Adventures That Don't Suck. I want to extend a good thank you to Goodman Games for allowing us to record this seminar. You can find a link to their website on ours at www.canadiancrusaders.com. And be sure to keep checking in over the next couple weeks for more audio that we've recorded at Gen Con. On with the show!
This is Eric, is Ethan's older, smarter, better-looking brother. I am at the Goodman Games How to Write Adventures That Don't Suck. It is about 5 till 7 on Friday, August 17th at Gen Con number 40.
I assume you guys are here for the seminar, How to Write Adventures That Don't Suck. Is that what everybody is here for? Excellent. All right. Get a little bit of the bookkeeping out of the way first. Joseph can't be here right now. He's actually in at a seminar with Wizards of the Coast, a little thing called 4th Edition. By the way, please don't ask us about that. We planned a seminar before the announcement. We can't really get into it because we really know about as much as you guys know. So it's going to change everything. And the company just has not figured out what we're doing, and we're not about ready to make a snap decision. So let's not spiral into that. Let's just kind of assume that that hasn't happened, and maybe it'll go away. No. Anyway, so let's just not spiral into that, and there's going to probably be a lot of what-ifs regarding that. So let's just try to focus on how to write adventures, some basics on structure and everything. First, we're going to start just talking about who our panelists are here today. And when Mr. Goodman shows up, obviously we'll have a big introduction. Actually, we should all heckle him when he meets him. But I didn't say that, though. So, all right, I'm just going to start here. I'll save myself for last because I'm going to be doing a lot of talking and I need a break. So starting here at my left, I'm sure you guys know who this guy is. He is, if he is not Goodman Games' face, I don't know who is. But this
Goodman Games got a lot of
this
there.
Is Harley. Say a few words, my man.
My name is Harley Stroh. I'm the line editor for Dungeon Crawl Classics. I've written 11 or so adventures, give or take, and done some freelance fiction for Wizards of the Coast and some other projects for some other companies. But yeah, Dungeon Crawl Classics is where I do the bulk of my freelance work these days.
Hi, I'm Adrian Palmier. I'm also one of the Goodman Games authors. I've had my finger in a lot of different pies, contributed to a whole lot of the projects that they've done, a lot of the compilations, and the new Mega Dungeon. So, I'm happy to answer any questions you guys have.
Hi, I'm Mike Ferguson. I've written a bunch of other ones, and I've also been involved in some of the various projects, the tournaments. Stuff I've written includes Curse of the Emerald Cobra, Dreaming Cavern, Squaredar, and I think it's about 4 or 5 now total between like compilations and actual adventures. Again, I'll be happy to, if you have any questions on those specific things later on, great, but hopefully we can contribute something towards letting you know our thought process and how to write, again, something that doesn't suck.
Hi, my name is Brennan LaSalle, and I've written 2 Dungeon Crawl Classics and a few other small Dungeon Crawl things, and I also created X-Brawl, and I've written almost all of the X-Brawl modules that are out right now.
Hi, I'm Ted Hart. I've edited a lot of the Gunther Walls, and I've also edited all of the comments that you've heard so far. So any if you see any punctuation errors in what they're saying, I will then commit Howard Hager. Also, I've edited many of the Dragon Mech and Ecoscope books for different games, as well as DCCs. And my first DC I've written will be in an upcoming collection.
Number 48.
Yep.
If you guys don't know who I am, my name is Chris Doyle. I've been writing DCCs for a while. Actually, I got my start with many different companies. I used to work for West End Games and their Star Wars line. I know that's dating me right now, but Dungeon Magazine, a bunch of others that I don't really recall at this moment. I've written a bunch of DCCs, 0, 7, 11, 13, 15. I was the person who kind of created the framework for the DCC tournament that we run each year. Next year's our 5th anniversary. Come out, support us, yay, everybody has a good time with it. And also, I think I was involved in that box set too, of some minor repute. First of all, can everybody hear us all right with the, or do we need the microphone? So, we can do the microphone thing, I don't mind about that. So, some of us are been working the hall already quite a bit. So some of us are already a little on the horse side, so we'll try and do the passing of the microphone thing around to make things work. First question I guess we have is, what are you guys looking for out of this? We're going to go and take a stab in the dark and assume that you guys are looking to get published. I mean, is that your show of hands? Is that what people are looking for? A couple people looking to kind of break in? They want to know some of the tricks of the trade? All right, not too many people. Are you guys looking to improve your home games? Is that what you're kind of hoping for?
Wrong.
This could be more fun than I thought then. So obviously you guys are seeing something that you like in the DCC line, I'm assuming, or something else that Goodwin Games is doing, and that's why you're here. So you're trying to figure out like what it is that we're doing. You have a question, sir?
Yeah, I just want to point out one topic is what's going to change with fourth edition.
Okay, and you missed my earlier announcement. Really snide, so you've already missed it. No. Like I said, we know about as much as 4th edition as everybody in the room right now, so we really can't tailor. I mean, we talked about this seminar like 6 months ago, so, and 4th edition wasn't even a twinkle in our eye.
But will 4th edition be OGL?
Yes, sir. It will be OGL, yes. So we will be supporting it in some capacity. What that capacity is, we do not know. And that's really
the rule set. I mean, the elements of the story, the elements of the structure are the same. They're consistent no matter what.
Exactly. So, and we really don't want this to spiral into what Goodwin Games is going to be regarding 4th edition, because that's really what we're not here for tonight. If everybody's looking for that, feel free to just like right now. But anyway, so that's what you guys are looking for. So, all right, there's a couple things we got via handout, and we're just going to go kind of in the bulleted points and just talk about a couple of different things that we feel is important to the process, or actually the process itself of writing a good adventure. Everybody has a different opinion, and most of these are actually, we polled all of our writers, and they all came up with different things, and we expanded our list and kept expanding. So we're just going to go right down in the line. We're going to talk about these. We're going to get a couple of insights from the panelists. If you guys have questions about the particular points, we'll take them. As long as it doesn't spiral out of control, we might have to put an end to it and move on to the next point. But honestly, I mean, you guys are going to get more out of it if you kind of tailor your questions to us. Look, we have one more author has made it. Mr. Jason Little entering the room, and he's going to say a couple of words about himself while he walks up here. So, don't sit in Joseph's seat.
I would never do that.
Yes. Do we have another chair over here? Okay, we got one over here for you. Say something about yourself, Jay.
Hello, I'm Jay Little. I've worked on several of the DCC modules, and I love freelance writing for Goodman Games because I love writing adventures that don't suck. Oh, he didn't hear that, did he? We can record that and play that back from later.
Got that.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, the first thing we're going to talk about is the adventure writing process. Now, everybody has a completely different process, so we probably shouldn't spend too much time on this, but just a couple things what we'll do is I'll tell you what I do basically right off the bat. The first thing you look for is an idea. You sit there, you come up with an idea, you say, well, this is what I want to do. Okay, then what do I do next? Well, then usually I outline it. I mean, that sounds pretty straightforward. And when I'm doing the outline, then I look to, okay, well, what do I want to achieve? What are the cool little bits about it? And sometimes I'll say, you know, well, hell, I really love Sturges, so how can I get Sturges in this damn thing?
Dark Mantles.
Or better yet, Sturges and Dark Mantles in the same encounter, because that's always good. So, and then obviously, then you jump into the actual writing process. Sometimes I actually, lately, depending on the project, I find it actually useful to actually do all the stats first, so I know what I'm working with. If you've ever tried to write tactics and you don't have your stat box done yet, it's actually kind of a problem.
I actually started doing that recently as well.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I do is that little encounter list that shows up first, stat block everything out, because trying to fill that in later, especially doing tactics, mess.
And it actually generates a lot of good ideas, because when you start looking at the stats of the monster, you start thinking of ways, hey, what can I do with this guy?
This guy's got reach.
He's amphibious. Hey, that must mean we could work something around that. So that is actually a very useful thing. Get your stat boxes done first. And most people actually dread that part of it, unless they're the stat crazy people who love doing stats. Then they love that part, and then they're not so good at the other parts.
There are two advantages to doing it that way, too. One of them being the fact that you get the hardest, most time-consuming part out of the way, or one of the more time-consuming parts. And secondly, that's one of the best ways to fine-tune an encounter. You love the concept, you love the idea. Playtesting has shown that it's difficult, but, well, now that you have the stat block, you can say, well, we can scale this back a little bit, we can reduce their strength a little bit, maybe we change the weapon type. Once you have that stat block, you have a lot more flexibility with all the other design decisions you're making.
Excellent point. The next part is, and this people probably very into, this is, a rough draft. I mean, you gotta start somewhere, you know. Some people start at the beginning of the adventure, they write the background and everything first, and then they go through plenty of encounters. I'm sure everybody does it differently. I mean, that's usually what I do. I usually write it fairly chronologically. I mean, I sit there, I write my background first, that's the basis of the story, and then usually I write my early encounters, and then I usually go kind of building up to some sort of climax. Do not sit in Joseph's chair. Thanks, that's good.
So, if you want to share, you got here on time.
We have one more panelist. This is Mr. Luke Johnson. Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Hey, Luke. Hi, I'm Luke Johnson. I got lost coming here. And I've also written some adventures. I've been a freelancer for 5 years, full-time for 2 years. You know, I'm dirt poor, but doing what I love, so whatever. For Goodman Games, I've written a couple Dungeon Crawl classics. Also, I'm the editor-in-chief of the Wicked Fantasy Factory, which produces kobolds exploding and sorts of adventures. And I've worked for a bunch of other stuff like Wizards of the Coast and White Wolf and that sort of thing.
All right. So obviously, a rough draft needs to be written. Some people believe it or not, they write them by hand. Some people just sit in front of a computer, punch them out, whatever works for you. I mean, you know, I used to actually write them by hand only because my brain went faster than I could type. And I would get very frustrated if I was sitting in front of a screen and I like had all these cool ideas and couldn't get them out, so I would write them down. The other important part of the part when you're actually getting ready to write your draft is sometimes just writing concepts down. Sometimes, you know, and it's nothing like when we did Castle White Rock, which is big. I had a notebook with me, and it actually almost always came, not always came around with me, but it was usually nearby somewhat. And I would just come up with a concept or a thought, and, you know, I will be the first person to admit, you know, I pulled ideas from Sesame Street, I pulled ideas from movies, pulled ideas from novels. Everything is material. Yeah, driving in a car, and you drive by, and you see an exit for some place, and you're like, that's a really cool name, you know, jot that sucker down.
Conversation over an elevator is material.
Yeah, so always...
material to steal is not fantasy game-related material. It's amazing how many times you'll be in a mall and you just walk by like a furniture store, and again, you see like the name of something, you're like, okay, castle whatever, or royal family whatever, just because it sounds cool, and you're not automatically thinking, all right, but Tolkien already did that.
Yeah, exactly. The other classic thing, too, is to take something and just change it a little bit, you know. Castle White Rock, it's not particularly original, so it didn't take too many stretches to kind of get to that final name. So, I mean, that's another thing, so always look for, you know, come with an idea, but you're like, oh, that's too Tolkien-like, but you know what, we'll switch it around a little bit, you know, add a few letters, take a few letters away. So sometimes the running journal thing, it's a great way to go from that basic, you know, rough draft part to the actual writing of the rough draft to then what, you know, we would call the final manuscript before we get to the final manuscript. There's a very, very important step, and it's probably the most important step that Goodman Games probably works harder than, in my opinion, any other company that I've worked for as a freelancer, and that's playtesting. And the problem with that is you need playtesters. You need good playtesters. You need them that are brutally honest, that can convey their problems with it, that know the rules, and also you can send them something and say, I need comments in 2 weeks, not 2 months. And that is a problem. And Goodman Games is always looking for playtesters. If that's something that interests you, you should be sending us an email, because we playtest everything that we do. And when it comes to our tournament modules, we playtest them several times. And it makes the process a little bit harder, because then we've got version 1, 2, 3, 4. How many versions of Vault have? 10?
11? Yeah, and this year's like the X-Crawl DCC, each round had at least 12 versions.
Yeah, because they would go through a playtest and then redo the version and then playtest that. And then at some point, you got to keep in mind that at some point you got to say, hey, this is what it's going to be. But
you're never going to get anything absolutely perfect here, 100% satisfaction. That will never happen. But you know, at some point you have to say, this is as good as I can possibly make this. You know, maybe it's all because the deadline is looming. You know, those are kind of important. But eventually you're going to come to kind of a peace with, this is awesome, or this is okay, this is good enough, I'll pick it out. And yeah, the editor hates it, he'll get back to you. Yeah.
Question?
Is it chilly for the open tournament?
So, excuse me.
Yeah.
Have you already had the open tournament this year?
Yes, we have. Okay. Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Round one ended up today.
Yeah. Yes. Round one ended up. The results are posted in the Unions Center if anybody needs to know.
It is possible when you're playtesting too, like, and it makes it difficult, particularly if you have like a small group of friends who you work with and you're like, okay, I can use them as a playtesters. Make sure they're the kind of friends that can be brutally honest with you, and because you are doing yourself ill favors writing, if anything you write, you're like, how do I like the adventure? Oh, I loved it, it was great.
That's no good.
Absolutely
yeah.
No good.
Yeah. I got one more comment.
So
go ahead, Brent.
No, I said it fits. So many of you are here to improve your home campaigns. People really don't play test for that kind of thing. The next best thing to that, if you're going to for your home campaign, what I suggest is before you actually sit down and write it all down, take up all the character sheets and look at all the character sheets and make sure that your adventure has something for each one of them specifically to use their special skills, their special items, their special whatever for. Like, actually go through and make a checklist and say, okay, my dungeon, I've got two clerics, so I've got to have this kind of undead, this kind of hazards and situations for them to do. Something that will have to be checked. Exactly. Right. And also, if you don't have a rogue, don't put 15 traps per level. That's just harsh.
Yes, one more point. Keep in mind your DCs of things. If your adventure is really important on a spellcraft DC 25 check, make sure there's a really good chance that the PCs can do that. And if they can't do that, and they really need to know it, you got to dumb that down. Because if they're going to sit there and be stuck at this one point and frustrated, no one's winning out of that situation. So that's why it's really important. Know the player character. You should always know, but in the case of the tournament, we know the pre-generated characters. So we know what they can do, and we can actually get right down to the percentage. Like, yeah, they should have a 75% chance to find this. And often what we do is when there's an important plot point that might need a spot check or something, we'll make that really low because you really want them to succeed. Otherwise, your game is going to come to a grinding halt. Question right there, then we'll get to you.
Regarding playtesting, what kind of playtesting do you guys look for when you have people playtest? And exactly how rigorous do you look for? To break the system or just to play?
It depends. Our tournament adventures, we are looking to break it. We're looking to break it, and we're looking to make the encounters better. Now, and that doesn't mean we're making it really hard, because in the case of this year's, we actually had pretty much an unbreakable encounter in the beginning that we had to then dumb back down.
Bring it back down.
We had to bring it back down because it was too much. And so it kind of goes both ways. But now for the regular DCCs, we're not necessarily looking for that, unless that's the goal of that particular DCC or other product. So it all depends on what our ultimate goal is.
A good point about playtesting with that, though, for thoroughness, is that if you do have a home group that you playtest with or run things by, they're more familiar with your style, with your campaign, with your way of presenting puzzles and traps. So some of the best feedback that I get are from playtesters that I've never met with, never played with before, because they're looking at traps, or looking at encounters, or looking at these challenges from a perspective that my group and my way of thinking would have never thought of. So they're like, hey, you've got this room in here where you got to activate a lever. Can I mage hand it? Is it light enough for that? Well, what about can the ranger shoot it with an arrow? And they take a look at all these different things. So sometimes a bolt list of, hey, for option A, you say that you can solve it in these two ways. Here are a few ways that our team came up with. Would these work? Some of them are like, hey, that's a great idea. And ones you're like, no, that doesn't really fit the concept. So whether or not you integrate directly the feedback that you get from those people, it can really help you shape and refine so that it's very, very clear what you're looking
for. Good point, Jack. You had a question right there real quick?
Yeah, just you're talking about, so you have an important plot point that you really want to have a low dice check on. But what do you do if, you know, all five of your players miss it? Do you have an alternate way then?
That's really when you're running the game. Not the purpose of our seminar. So I mean, our seminar is actually designing the adventures, and basically the point with that is.
I disagree with that because if you have especially if it's early on in the adventure, if there's an important point that you want to make sure they get. Do you just then assume that they make sure it's like they're guaranteed to get it? Or you then come up with an alternate path that may take an extra hour.
Yeah.
Right. And depending on like what your word count range is and like, you know, what kind of level of detail you're willing to invest into it, it would make sense if they miss plot point A, there are three other ways that they can achieve that same plot point.
So you usually come up with that and
that's depending. You can't always do that.
Depending on the style of module you're trying to write. Or adventure you're trying to write. But yes.
Or as you said, particularly with a group like mine, when you do have the track encounter and you actually do have the rogue, but everybody's too damn dense to
crash it. Believe it or not, yes. Foils many good adventure designers.
That's what
it happens. I mean, you know. It happens.
How to make players don't suck. We can't do that.
Exactly. At that point, get the better players.
I know.
That's just to feed off an earlier point. When I do an adventure, a lot of it is I actually despise the encounter that says if they do not all make their saving throw or they do not all make their search spot, whatever DC, there is absolutely no way you can progress in this dungeon. You're really boxing yourself if that's the case. As Chris said, my personal preference is, all right, their life will be easy or much easier if they achieve this, and I try to tie it more to players being clever rather than, okay, oh, you're all roll two.
You guys have been waiting. I'm sorry.
I just want to say one thing about playtesting for those of you who aren't really planning on publishing and have a home group. You know, in today's world, we all have, like, people we know, friends of ours who don't live nearby. Like, I have a gaming friend in Massachusetts. And it's like, well, I'm writing something for my home campaign. He and I might just bounce ideas off each other because, you know, he's not playing in my game. I'm not playing in his home campaign. So we just trade in thoughts like that. So that's kind of an informal type of play testing. Just get someone outside of your group who knows this stuff, who may, you know, be a good sounding board.
I was going to say that for an extremely important plot point, like how the players have to find the dungeon or something along those lines where there's absolutely nothing you can do if they don't do it, build in a couple of redundancies, you know? I thought specifically of the first dungeon crawl I did, which was the Sunless Garden. And there was a map they could find tracks, or there was a dog there, and if they could speak to animals, the dog would lead them to find their master who was lost. But, you know, put in three ways there, because otherwise they don't get to the dungeon and you're sitting around.
You know, I think one of the things we forget is that some of the best fiction, some of the best adventure stories do have imminent failures that really redesign.
Exactly.
The Lord of the Rings is perfect. They can't get across Brandon. So they go through Moriah, but, you know, Gandalf can't figure out what the Elvish name is for friends. So they sit there for hours trying to figure that out. And that builds some reality into some.
It does. And that's really where your game master comes in, where your game master has to be the one who's going to know their team and know their particular play style and is going to be the one that's going to be able to adjust on the fly. And much like Brandon said, even if the module doesn't have that written in it, well, maybe he just quick throws in a dog because he knows there's a druid in the party and that druid always talks to him, or the gnome always speaks to the burrowing animal. You know,
all the time.
Something like that.
When you guys design modules, how much do you take into account the contingency planning? When you sit down and you say, this is where I want the module to go, but there's obviously so many ways. At what level of depth when you're writing the module do you begin to go, okay, that's not what I want to touch on, but how far down that tree do you want to go?
That's probably different for each writer. And believe it or not, unfortunately, word count does come into play with that. Because you can't just write an endless number of words. inspected to get published. But anyway, so it depends on what you're dealing with. I mean, if you're writing a 32-page DCC, there's only so much you can do. And if you're writing a high-level 32-page DCC, where 60% of it's going to be stat boxes, you don't have that much wiggle room. And sometimes if you're trying to add additional plot points, you might have to sacrifice them because you need to have those contingencies in there.
I think it works well, almost like a Visio flowchart. I usually have the characters start here, here's the player beginning, they're going to end up here, the battle with the evil wizard. Okay, I have room for 5 steps in here, and this one branches off into 2 sub-ones, and you can kind of visually map out. I do a lot of website development, so like creating a site map for my adventure, taking a look at it in that direction, then I can see, you know what, I got one too many steps in here. And then those aren't necessarily rooms or encounters, it's concepts, and then from that I can break it down into, well, for this step, I can make this a room they have to get through, a creature they have to fight, a puzzle. But being able to see that, they start here, they end there, how many steps in the process, page count, word count, plays a big part of that. But as long as you have your end goal in sight, you can add or remove to be able to reach that end goal.
I don't like editing a movie. Excuse me. Luke needs to talk.
I ran over here. Come on. Why don't be useful? We mentioned a lot about word count and stuff, and I think it's important to point out that it's not just, oh, I have 15,000 words to write this and I can't fit all these plot points in, which I'd really like to do. It has to do with the fact that the guys who play our adventures don't want to read 5 pages of plot points and possible contingencies and things like that. There's a certain amount of it's in the GM's hands that's implicit in all adventure design. So there's a reason those word counts are in there, and it's not just because we don't want to print more pages. It's because you guys don't want to read more pages.
Any more questions on that first bulleted point about the design process or anything?
Well, not so much a question, but in terms of designing, one thing I always find very helpful for me, even working on my home campaign, is keep asking yourself questions. Like, you can think of a concept like, oh, this monster group would be really cool to throw at my players. But then ask yourself, well, why is this monster here? What is the evil wizard's goal? What is his purpose? Because sometimes that blank page or that blank screen can be very intimidating. You think, oh, I have to start writing down ideas. Right? Think of questions first, and then as you think of the questions, the answers may come to you, and that can take the campaign or your adventure in a completely different idea, different path than what you had when you first thought of that particular creature or that particular villain.
Any other questions or anything? We're moving on. We should have time at the. Hopefully, we'll have time at the end. So, if anybody wants to revisit anything, also we'll be able to hang around a little bit afterwards. If anybody wants to do some one-on-one or two-on-one or 10-on-1 or something like that. So Adrian is going to discuss our next point. Jump at it, man.
What Ken was just talking about bleeds really nice into what I was going to say. And was just talking about very similar to, you know, the internal logical consistency of your adventure. Something I like to refer to as the octopus in the cave. Okay, if you got a deep, deep, deep cave, and there's a saltwater octopus, there's no freshwater. You know, it's a freshwater cave. Why is the octopus in there? In your mind, it may look really cool. It's an octopus. It's got fire. Maybe it's got like 10 eyes or something. Maybe it's got horns. Why is it there? What's it living on? How did it get there? You know, what's this octopus all about? So sometimes you have to like take what sounds like a really good idea and make it fit into a quasi-realistic sense. I mean, we're talking about a fantasy game. We got halflings running around in like plate mail armor with like flails and stuff. So, you know, reality has to be stretched a little bit. We all understand this, but it still sort of has to make sense. You have to have an ecology. If the troglodytes live in this cave, does the cave smell bad? Do you smell them coming like a long time away? Like, does their gear smell bad? Do you put it on, does that stuff still smell bad? Do all their neighbors really hate them, so they have like barricades and like air freshener around and that kind of thing? That would make sense, because if I was living in these troglodytes, I would certainly do that. So that's something you really have to look at. Does anybody have any questions on this sort of sentiment? See where I'm going with this?
Well, to follow up on Adrian's point, sure. I think you hear in a lot of cooking shows and things like that, that people eat with their eyes first. You know, like, it's not just the main sense that you think is the only one that dominates or dictates how somebody processes information. There are so many senses that I think a lot of writers overlook to describe. Smell is probably one of the most important ones that can add a touch of realism or grit or a distinction.
Threat.
Yeah, the sounds are pretty easy because you've got spot. I mean, listen, and what things look like with spot and search get tied into die rolls, but how do things smell? How do things feel? you open this door handle and it's slick and oily, or the floor is sticky. I mean, these things just create these extra questions in the player's minds of what's going on here, what's really underneath all of these other senses that we're encountering.
And a really kind of neat thing to do is to throw this kind of stuff in and have it sort of be a red herring, because players will make up the craziest things you didn't even think of. Right?
That's the most important.
If that's an oily door, oh my god, this is going to burst into flames, or oh my god.
This is something very, very important we learned earlier on. Any door that gets a description is immediately a take 20 search check. If you walk into a door without a description, oh, I just opened it.
Or even when you go into a room, like when we do a various room for a dungeon, it's like, okay, our standard thing, all right, the ceiling is 10 feet high, the walls are this, or the ceiling is now 30 feet high. Why is it 30 feet? Why is it 40 feet? Why is it 50 feet? Why is it, all of a sudden, it's just like, what's going on with this? And it's all, and the best thing you can do is actually nothing. It's just hot. Yeah. It's just this. But suddenly, your characters are going around, and meanwhile,
they're almost storytelling for you. They're almost, yeah, let them. Yeah. If that's the case, if they're going to start making crazy stuff up because it's 40 feet high and domed, why is it domed?
I have gotten great ideas from my players in my home campaign just because they come up with crazy theories. I'm like, wow, that's better than what I had.
it fits
perfectly.
And for a home game, like, I've done this with puzzles where I have my whole puzzle, I'm giving it, it's supposed to be tough, and you know, it makes the Da Vinci Code look like tic-tac-toe, and it's real simple. And you go, and they come up with a solution, and for my home game, and they'll say, and it's solution X, and I have P on the paper. But you're going, they worked through this, their explanation makes total sense. I'm not going to tell them they're wrong in my home game, because if you heard their logic process in your own home game, why are you going to punish them for going through, okay, they've spent 20 minutes talking about this round table, and you really can't find a fault in their logic apart from it's completely wrong. So, at that point, for a home game, that's what I would recommend. Don't, for a home game, if you come up with like a diabolical puzzle or something like that, don't be so married to your solution to where it's the only solution. Same with a published module. If they rattle off something and you're running it at home, there's no reason why theirs can't work just as well as what's written in the module. As long as you've heard that they're just throwing stuff out there, then no, they shouldn't get any credit for it. But give them credit for trying to work things through.
Keep in mind, players, they like to succeed. And we're all here for them to have fun, and for the Game Master to have fun. And it's a lesson we've definitely learned in doing the tournament module year in, year out, is we're trying to make it smaller and smaller, less number of encounters, because, you know, we want people to get to the end. You know, the first couple years we did it. Yeah. So it's like, because, you know, they want to get to the end. Even if they all die in the last encounter, they want to have that sense of accomplishment, like, we did it. Maybe we didn't win the day completely, but we want to get to the end, and, you know, that makes them really happy.
The best idea in the world does no good if nobody lives to see it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Sorry, I keep asking one question.
That's all right.
When you guys sit down to design a game, and you're thinking through a lot of these contingency thought processes, and you put this down, do you end up mostly designing for a game that you would like to play through, or do you actively try and make it as broad as possible for everybody else?
That's a really, really good, solid question. a lot of times, now it depends. This is a little bit different to designing actually published product versus your home campaign. Home campaign, yeah, a lot of it's going to be dictated on who is your audience, okay? Who's playing your game? Do they want story-driven? Do they want combat-driven? Do they want politic-driven, okay? The published side of it, very much different. Sometimes you're given, you know, here, I want a module that's low-level, you know, run with it. Other times it's like, you know, I want this, you know, we want Sphinx, you know? That's what you want, and sometimes you'll get a little bit more than that. So
there are kind of two sides to that. Sometimes you'll submit an idea or a proposal, like a resume for your concept, saying, I'd really like to write about this concept. So that's, I think, a little bit more of a personal investment. When I wrote Mask of Death, which was based on the Gamers movie, that was more of a Joseph saying, hey, I know you like the movie. These guys are interested in a module. Would you write this very specific module? So there was already a concept in place, and I had some wiggle room, but it was very, very clear what the module needed to accomplish. So there are really two different approaches to how you arrive at a writing assignment. But they're still fun.
And maybe a better way to frame that is not, you know, what would I like to play, or what would be most general, but what do you feel the most passionate about? And that sounds totally corny, but it's true for home games, it's true for published games. The ones that are good are the ones that, like, you can see it so perfectly in your mind, like, this I may not want to play it, but this is the coolest thing I can come up with right now, and it's so cool that we're going to put it down, and we're going to run you guys through it. And if as a home GM, you're feeling that, your characters, your players are going to eat it up. You know, they feed off that love, you know? And you get all the excitement, you know, they're discovering this thing that you've envisioned so fully. And then when it comes to publishing it, I mean, it's really clear in the submissions we get, the ones that somebody felt really strongly about this adventure idea.
Comments from the panel? Anybody questions? All right.
Any other? One more thing about maintaining internal logic and something. We all have at least one somewhat understanding friend who isn't a gamer. I would think, I would hope. I like to bounce some of my more oddball ideas off someone who isn't a gamer whatsoever. And if it makes sense to them, it'll probably make sense to us. So that's a little trick that I use. Throw that out.
Any other comments on the five senses of the dungeon? We did talk about that a little bit already.
Which taste? Do we taste anything?
Tastes great.
Stop licking the dungeon.
How many times? You need to taste.
But really, hold on, really quickly. But one last sense, right? So like Jurassic Park, right? It's the coolest scene when, boom, you know, there's the sound. We don't even see the T-Rex. We hear it, and then we see the tremor. And so how often do we get into riding tremors? We need to, like, more tremors.
We need to watch the movie Tremors.
A lot of times you boil it down when you're riding to, okay, this is all dependent on whether or not they made the spot check. I actually prefer, no, you all see it, you just don't know what it is. It's like, okay, you all saw the statue glow for a second, and then it didn't glow anymore.
Yeah.
You all saw it, no die rolling needed. Now what does that mean? And that's when you get the panic mode and the players go, oh my god, what the hell was that?
Which raises fake spot checks. I mean, just, you know,
right.
Roll. Well, what are we trying
roll,
to do?
Okay.
Just give me a roll.
Because somebody was off in the corner casting a light bulb, and that was it. And that's the real enemy they should be looking for. But meanwhile, it's like, okay, spot check, where is it? It goes beyond just make this senses about checks. You really want to start thinking about more, how can I make it so even though they see it, they hear it, they touch it, what does it mean? And let their interpretations dictate the next motion that the adventure takes.
Question?
Yeah, how do you make memorable NPCs? Because in my game, the most memorable NPC I made was by accident. The player, just in a random encounter, saw the goblin's labors with this orc, double MVG, and they liked him so much.
Before you go any further, now, did they know that you didn't make that NPC up?
Well, they...
Because they don't need to know.
Yeah.
They don't need to know that.
Yeah.
Run with it.
Yeah,
run with it. The most important thing to do is write down everything you do. Because when they come back to him again, you better have it right.
I'm with them.
Yeah, well. In that case, definitely write it down.
Now he searches for traps, right?
Yeah.
You,
but I still
attacked
him opportunity because he was unarmed.
Hey.
Interesting quirk. Here is this slave that's a double amputee. And I think that the NPCs that are really going to stand out are the ones that have something about them that is memorable. For your home campaign, give them, you know, a phrase or an action, or I like to imagine what actor would be playing them in the movie when it comes out.
Yep.
That's a great way to write. When you're writing for your own stuff, and really when you're writing for professional stuff too, you just have to find a way to make that come through without getting sued.
In my own games, the thing I have really come down to this point after a bunch of years is just I take the NPC, stat them up, do everything, and then it's wherever the players take them. I don't take effect. All the ones I've always gone, if this guy's going to be cool, he goes 3 seconds into his opening monologue, and the players go, boring, and it's hacking the deck. It always happens. And the ones, you're like, okay, you met a minstrel in the tavern, and then, what's the minstrel's name? Steve, I don't know. Why is he carrying a lute? Why is he carrying? Oh my god. For whatever reason, they picked up on Steve the Bard as the most cool NPC on the planet.
Yeah.
You just roll with it. Roll with it.
Personality. Write something down on top of the page.
These are great ideas for if you're running a game and someone just happens to show up. But in terms of designing adventures,
One way I like to make encounters that I hope will be memorable is to make cool things happen in the environment. Because in a great action movie, the environment always plays a key role. You hear it sometimes said that the setting is a character. And this is especially true when I write Wicked Fantasy Factory adventures, because those are supposed to be like action movies. So I've got rooftops with glass and rain raining down, and there's another one that takes place in a giant robot's brain, and people are running up and down on gears and riding up and down on chains and stuff like that. And I've got... there's another one I wrote. I'm so great about this. I'm not trying to toot my own horn here. I'm just saying these are things that I hope will make the encounters interesting. Where rocks are floating up and down over lava pits, or people have to move around from platform to platform. Anything where the characters have to move around, I think, ends up being memorable. And as a GM and as an adventure writer, if you write in the descriptions of those places and keep hitting them, you know, during the scene, you know, your sword slices through the raindrops as it seems to move in slow motion, you know, stuff like that. I think those things make for memorable encounters.
Well, and sometimes we forget that we have no special effects budget. There doesn't need to be a 10-foot corridor. We can be whatever we want. You know,
pool 15 by 15.
Yeah, expand. Dynamic environments are so much fun. They're so much fun to the players. They're so much fun to the GMs. They take a little bit more time, but it. You know, your players will never forget, you know, when the teeter-totter bridge is, you know, slowly falling away. Where there was the tomb of... Well, I forgot.
The Peak Force Pool.
I forgot. Thanks, Peter.
So I was just going to say, one thing to follow up on what Luke was saying is I think over the past few years since third edition, especially with 3.5, we've all gotten into that grid mentality, that two-dimensional way of thinking. And, you know, you gotta get back into three dimensions, like Luke was saying. Just, you know, don't be limited to that grid pattern and miniatures and kind of scoping it out. Think high, think low, think things moving in and out of the frame.
I had a question about equipment. There have been occasions where I've seen very neat, cool equipment that's, you know, shown the way it's supposed to be shown to players. Then they take down the NPC, and you have this issue where they get it and they get to run with this thing that you may not want to have, or you have to snag it back in someone, you know, some way that you know is going to disappoint them. Have you guys run into that at all?
Oh yeah.
I would get robbed.
Yeah.
They're walking around with a golden, you know, great sword that, you know, shivers beautifully in the light with adamantine studs. They're walking around in town with your
I'm going to cut off Brendan here, because I was late. Because I ran into this exact problem with an adventure I just designed for Wicked Fantasy Factory again called Against the Iron Giant, the one of the giant robot, where I wanted to have these, called the magic gears, where you stick them on your armor and they turn and they have glowing runes on them and they give you bonuses, basically just because I thought they would look cool and that people would like to pick them up. And at first I was like, these things work only when you're in the Iron Giant, and afterwards they fall off and become unmagical.
How many times have we had that?
just because I was like, this would be really cool, but they would be too powerful later on. I don't want to lose them because I think they're really cool, and they'd be too powerful later on, so this is it. And playtesting came back, and everyone was like, I'm really pissed off about how we can't use these later on. I earned them, goddammit. And so the final version of the adventure, I believe this went through layout, you get to keep them, but I throw in the caveat that they're permanently stuck to that piece of armor. You know, so if you want to swap it out for better armor or whatever, then you'll have to lose it. There's another weapon of the same sort of thing in that adventure, and as you can probably tell, it's sort of a pseudo-fantasy science thing. And so there's this spear you can get that, you know, shoots lasers or whatever. And it's really powerful. It is. And if you bring it to, you know, I decided, you know, GMs, this would be worth about this much. However, if you don't want these third-level characters to be running around with that kind of loot from selling the single spear, maybe no one takes them seriously, or maybe it works only for the person who can put it together, or maybe, you know, blah, 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 blah. So leave it basically up to the GM, but give them some ideas about what they can do to still have these cool things in their adventures, but not necessarily have PCs get involved.
The other thing about that is, too, is most of your more powerful items you can easily turn into intelligent items, and that's exactly what they are. They're intelligent. So, you know, maybe you want them to have a holy sword, but you're like, uh-oh, wow, that holy sword is really unbalancing things. Well, that holy sword, if it's intelligent, it's got its own opinions on things, and maybe it's not always going to want to be used, or maybe you need to stud its scabbard with gems, or try and create some kind of a drawback to it. You know, maybe it will purposely not let you draw it or something. Or try and come up with some kind of balancing thing that doesn't seem too contrived that's going to get your players ticked off. Like, you know, oh, as soon as you set foot out of the thermal bars, it doesn't work, you know, kind of thing. Because we've seen that. I mean, it's kind of a cop-out, you know.
And if you do that, somehow warn the players beforehand that it's not going to work afterwards so they don't feel totally cheated.
Yeah, exactly.
Another interesting thing, I think Brenda did a great thing when he designed X-Crawl. The nature of X-Crawl, if you're not familiar with it, you get prizes for completing these live pay-per-view events. You can't loot the bodies of the people that you beat during the encounters. When I wrote the tournament for this year, and so I got to play with the rules a little bit more, I'm like, dude, this is great. You can kit out some enemies with anything you want, and you just create provisions or restrictions. In X-Crawl, it's the law. In your game, it may be that they're confiscated when they leave the dungeon by the dwarf patrolman outside, but you can create some restrictions there. And then in terms of X-Crawl, okay, you cleared this room, you don't get the +2 keen sword that the fiendish vampire was using, but everybody in the team gets a +1 longbow and 3 potions of healing. There are other ways that you can reward players, and remember, you can choose rewards that aren't magic items. They're popular. They get a tract of land. They get the deed to an abandoned mine that turns into a whole other series of adventures. So there are a lot of ways that you can get out of that mind lock of just equipment-based rewards.
Do you have any more comments on the, seeing encounters as a scene in a novel, video game? No one has lots of questions.
In the contingency, when you're playing between modules or between adventures, how much do you guys actually put into seeding for the next adventure? At the end, it's, to be continued. And do you guys do that with your modules? And if so, to what extent?
We really try not to, actually. We do have a couple of our modules are like, trilogies and sequels that we like to actually do them kind of more after the fact that it's kind of like, a lot of our stuff is supposed to be world neutral, drop right in, use it. But it's always there that you might revisit it, come back and do like 17 and then 17.5. But we try not to do those ahead of time. There's a couple of example, exceptions to the rule, obviously. But now in your home campaign, that's much more important because you need to be doing that. You need to be going right in a row. So it all depends, again, when we're actually laying out, like when we sit there and say, a lot of times we'll wait to see the feedback from a particular DCC. Everybody loved number 17. Well, if everybody loved number 17, we must have done something right there, so let's give them something more like it, and trying to meet the demand of the fans. And that's really what's important, go to the Goodman Games forums and tell them, I really like this, or, no more, icy adventure.
Rather than after the fact of how we hook it into the next one, we kind of pre-hook it by every Dungeon Crawl Classic has ideas on 3, 4, or 5 plot hooks. I'm like, hey, here's a way that you can integrate this module into your campaign. So rather than worrying about what you're going to do next, we're telling you from wherever you ended up, here's how you can bring people into this storyline. Here's how you can introduce this plot to your party. So kind of reversing that.
Is it more marketable to have multiple plot hooks like that?
It really depends on who you're talking to. Yeah. I mean, if you've got a cool concept that you think people are going to want 3 adventures based on this particular villain or setting or whatever, then you run for it. But I mean, you notice most of the DCCs, they're usually very loosely connected, if that. It's not to say that we're not putting seeds in there that they could be connected. But for the most part, it's very different. You got to probably think, modular, drop in, drop out, because, the only the people that like that trilogy, well, they're going to buy it. But if you, 80% of the people don't particularly care for that first module, well, you just eliminated them. So yeah. It's a balancing act. We're kind of running out of time a little bit here, so we're going to try and move up a little bit. Like I said, we're going to hang around for a few minutes afterwards if people want to go back to a particular topic. Keeping adventures fresh, revisiting unused monsters, rules, environments. We talked about environments a little bit, but I think it's really worthwhile talking about some other concepts about, things that, nobody uses this particular monster, so, hey, let's do that guy, or let's make it a little bit different.
Yeah, and that pretty much says it. I can throw out some examples. If you want to use a monster that's already around, please give it some new spin. I wanted to use kobolds in one adventure, so I made them special, really pissed-off kobolds. Gave them some special rules and glowing face paint and whatnot, at least so they'd look different. And new environments we already mentioned, and what was the other new thing we were supposed to talk
rules.
About? Rules. Oh, there's plenty of rules in 3rd edition that don't get used, like grappling. Please don't include a lot of grappling. But there's a lot of cool rules about environments and fires and smoke and water and ice.
When's the last time you guys looked at the rules on forest fire?
Yeah. They're there.
Which yeah. Last time you had a monster that used Overrun or Sunder?
Right.
I mean,
so,
there are some killer ideas. Yeah.
So,
a memorable monster will Sunder your Great Sword.
Even Drowning. I mean, Drowning doesn't get used all that often either, you know, surprisingly.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can do is just pick up the rule book seriously and just start going through those sections that you always just skip through because you were bored and you're going, eh, when am I going to use this? This is when you're going to use it. In the DMG, you start going through, like, the environment stuff. It's scary how many times you can go through looking for a concept going, I really want something like shock and awe tactic in here, and then you just come across that one paragraph and you're like, whoa, is this in the SRD? Yes, it is. You're going in. And it's brilliant, but it's just there for the taking. It's not really anything that it requires much work on your part apart from just find it and then figure out how you're going to exploit it from there.
Two more examples, real quick, and I will get to your question. First one is, yeah, everybody knows what a rust monster looks like, all right? The second the party sees the rust monster, they know what it is. So DCC 29, our collection of short ones, someone came up with a rust spider. It's a spider, and it does what a rust monster does. But you know what? Nobody knows that until it touches the very first sword. And you know what? It's one of the more it actually hung around. We put it in our monster collection, and it's like, it's, you know, we've used it again before. Other authors like latched onto that and said, whoa, this is really cool, because they're never going to think that spider is going to rust up, or its webs are going to rust it. So look at that. The other thing, and I wish I had an example right now, and I'm sure six will fly around in a second, but look for pairing two types of monsters that work really good together.
Like Stellan from Vault of the Dragon Kings.
There you go.
A half-dragon Etten. So you've got all the double-dose goodness of the two-headed Etten, but oh, they're both dragon heads.
Yeah.
Which is just the more memorable monsters people have
mentioned. Makes it really fun. Definitely. You had a question?
God.
Grapple. Who wants to handle that?
If only that one.
The nightmare that I've been explained to me, I mean, your god, it's your campaign, you're running it, who you say, there you take the finger of God.
Yes. Yes. Hi, everybody, come on.
It's your game.
It's a warm, fuzzy moment.
Your game.
Come on. Yeah, that is true. Yes, you are God, and like I said, do what you want to do. If your group uses Grapple all the time, streamline it.
Please,
know?
By God.
You
know, and then set it to watch.
Don't use that word streamline.
Remember, if they grapple your God, you grapple, then go for a pin immediately. They'll be like, what? They can't do that. Yes, they can.
And at 8 o'clock, we're going to do a special Grapple seminar after this. And these guys are actually going to demonstrate it. So. Any more comments on unused stuff? Anybody have any? We are seriously almost out of our time. We've had so much fun.
Well, the question I had is, you know, once you've got your adventure written down and you think it's ready to go, how do you get it out there to see if somebody wants to publish it?
That's kind of what we thought tonight was going to be all about. We were really kind of surprised it wasn't, and for the three or four people in here, that's really what they're here for. That's a great question. Each company is really different. A couple of the basic rules are: A, know the company that you want to get published in. Okay, when I say know them, you don't need to necessarily be friendly with somebody on their staff, although it doesn't hurt. However, know their products. Know their products inside and out. If you want to write a Conan adventure, you better be really good at Conan. You better not just be, oh, I think Conan's kind of cool, but, you know, I didn't see the movies or I didn't read the books. So you need to know your material. If you want to write a DCC, you better know the DCC line. Because I hate to tell you, we'll know if you know the DCC line. If you submit something, there's 59 of them right now, you submit something that's like one of the other ones, well, you didn't do your homework. And so that's probably the most important thing. Now, all game companies have websites. They're going to be very clear on their website what their submission guidelines are. Most of them will not take unsolicited submissions. So you need to get past that part. You need to probably get published somewhere who does. In the past, Dragon Magazine and Dungeon Magazine was that avenue. RPGA was that avenue. I'm not sure if RPGA still does that kind of thing, and I really can't comment on that. But that is...
What I've got was small enough for Dungeon.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, and everybody's got their own rules. They all have different word counts and different ways they write their contracts and everything. So the key thing I'm trying to drive, know who you're going to target, all right, and talk to them, you know, email them. Make sure you're not doing a 50,000-word submission not knowing if they're going to take it or not, because, you know, because you might get a one-line email back saying, we don't take unsolicited, you know, look at our website, page 2, you know, it says, we're not going to look at your stuff unless, you know, we've asked you for
it. We want a 500-word summary. Don't send them a 20-page document.
Don't.
Because you think your idea is the one that breaks the mold.
Exactly.
Follow the rules. You're a lot more likely to get listened to.
Part of the submission process, at least the way I see it, is you are, especially if you're not published, you are trying to prove to the publisher that you can follow direction and that you are a good and, more important, easy person to work with. If you can't even get the submission down to, I want 2 or 3 pages, well, I'm going to send them 12. Right there, I don't even have to read if I'm the line editor, because I'm going, they couldn't even follow the direction that said 2 to 3 pages. They sent 12. What's the adventure going to look like if they can't get the submission format?
That's way overworked.
That is an excellent, excellent point. That's probably worth repeating more than anything. Hardly, you could probably speak to that more than anything else.
Yeah, well, most publishers will have writing guidelines or submission guidelines posted on their page. You know, for Goodman Games, we do take unsolicited proposals. You know, it'll be composed of a brief adventure synopsis telling us the sort of adventure that you'd like to write about. And then we also ask for a writing sample, which is a little bit onerous, but the purpose of that is to know, you know, most of our DCCs are 32,000 words or longer. And if we see in the query letter or in your writing sample that there's lots of errors, we know that by the time, you know, writing is difficult. You know, you have to handle the prose piece, you have to, you know, handle the mechanics piece. They don't have to be perfect. Both don't have to be perfect. But if there's errors in the query letter, I know by the time I hand 32,000 of your words off to Ken Hart, you know, if we couldn't get the 250-word query letter right, it's going to be a disaster for Ken. And so
it keeps me employed.
It seems corny, and I didn't understand it until I was on this side of things. But typos. I mean, we all make typos. I'll send you guys all emails, and you'll write me back, and you'll say, Harley, I would never take this query. You'd be absolutely right. But they have to be as clean as possible. They stand out immediately, and it's a bummer. But they're like black strikes against you right away. It's incredible.
Can you tell, like, 32,000 words is approximately how many pages?
That's a regular piece. Oh, you know, I don't.
Probably 24.
Isn't it like 25?
I don't look at it.
It's 700 words per page.
This could be why we're saying too many.
So, you know, yes, we do take unsolicited submissions. We're always, you know, looking for fantastic adventures. But for, at least for Goodman Games, it's not the case where you write the adventure first and then send me a short blurb. That could be a waste of your time. It'd be a great exercise to go through that process, but if the sole purpose of it is, you know, getting publishing credit, that's not how you want to go about it.
There's not a lot of companies out there right now that are looking for D&D 3.5 adventures, I should point out. Goodman Games, possibly the only one. I know D&D Insider, their new online initiative, is going to need some more Dungeon Magazine-style adventures. I think Green Ronin publishes a line of Bleeding Edge adventures or something like that.
Is Watsi still their open call for adventures?
I don't think so.
It's all changed.
So, like, you're pretty limited. Goodman Games is probably your best bet. So talk to Harley and pitch him your idea after the session. Yeah. All of it.
It's a grapple roll.
Low strength, I lose.
Just to shift off of the submission stuff a little bit. What are your guys' most successful modules, or maybe even your favorites, and why do you think they were successful?
I'm going to throw it right out there. It's without a doubt the DCC line, and that's probably because what we already discussed. They are modular. They are neutral. They're world neutral. They're all different levels, all different flavors.
Specifically
want to know which one.
Because you mentioned some of them, and I was just kind of curious.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, I think we really need to do something on the website where we get a lot of feedback from everybody on what they really, you know, what is everybody's top 10, because there's 50 of them now, and why. Because, quite frankly, and you know, I'm not going to name specific DCC numbers, but Joseph, who created the line, you know, he'll see a DCC and he'll look at it and be like, I'm committed to this, and put it out there. And then it turns out to be one of the most popular ones out there, and he's scratching his head. And he puts another one out the next month that he is completely in love with, and it's just received okay. And so the point of the matter is, one person, everybody's got a different opinion. Some people just really like Arctic Adventures. Some people really like the Underdark. Other people can't stand Underdark, so automatically they're going to hate that one. So it's difficult to get one that everybody loves.
Yeah.
You know.
I think the compilations have been very, very successful, like Adventure Begins. The DCC tourney ones, because the tournament has so much interest. There's a lot of content there. You've usually got the best of the best of the contributing writers, and it's gone through such rigorous playtesting and exposure that people just really seem to latch onto those in particular.
And there's really no recipe. There's no, you know, it's not like a recipe. You can't just... There are important things that need to happen. We need to have really sweet villains. We need to have a really cool environment.
We're not really asking for a recipe.
No. But
what your personal favorite?
Yeah, but are you really?
Is that the question?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
It's sort of why.
I followed my sponge, Russ
Spider, and that was the uniqueness of that one.
Your favorite DC guy?
I like the Area of the Crow God.
Yeah.
Brendan,
because
I was the Rocket.
Jason.
It would have to be Crypt of the Devilish. It was the first one I worked on.
Like you see it's Savage Kings. I read that. I was like, this is what it is.
Yeah.
I really like the Summon Star. Evil Train is kind of cool.
I like Crypt of the Devilish because it really reaches back to the Tome of Horrors kind of thing. And it just, you know, embodied everything that we did.
Yeah. Iron Crypt for me, probably.
I like the first book of Fantasy Factory Adventure I wrote.
DCC's man.
That makes kobolds explode.
Who doesn't like exploding kobolds?
So we don't mod you if we want to continue the conversation. Email, put an address on the board.
Okay, well, actually what we'd like to announce, we are done, we are out of time, and some people are leaving. We want to make a little bit of an announcement here. What we plan on doing is, if anybody's familiar with the Goodman Games website, we have a very active forum section. We are going to create, and I don't know when this is going online. It's been done. See, I already edited
it. I posted on it!
Dude, you'll have to say something about it. Because I didn't look at those forums.
Based on popular demand by the rabid fans of Goodman Games, who just can't get enough of this content, or a little bit of self-congratulations, we created the designers forum. Within the forums, there is a specific one where you can ask questions and the designers themselves are answered. Many of us are there daily on the Goodman Games forum answering questions that people have. In my home game, in this module, on this page, how should I do it based on my characters? And we love getting feedback from the fans. So we broke apart and actually created an area on the Goodman Games forums where you can ask the different designers questions directly.
It's called Adventure Design. It's a specific
Adventure Design. Let's have a big round of applause for Joseph Goodman for running this program. Honest, you know, it's not just us. We didn't just come up with them. You know what I mean? So, thank you guys for coming. I think at the highest part, I think we had about 62 people. We were only at 25. So, I think you'll see us back here again next year in a bigger room, hopefully.
Let's sit around.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.
Visit our website at www.canadiancrusaders.com. You can leave us an audio, call our voicemail line at 206-338-2414. Visit us on the Frapper map, send us an email, or go by the forums on Fistful of Comics, or go to our website and click on the forums link to get to the forums, and leave us a message there, and we'll get back to you absolutely as soon as we can. Thanks for listening. Gamers Haven Podcast is released under a Creative Commons non-commercial attribution share-alike 2.5 license and is a proud member of the Fistful of Comics podcast audio group. And if you swallow a drone, you'll be fast to die. There's a new sheriff.